This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk today. It's definitely an honor. I'm really excited. Let's talk about some things that are really close to my heart and that I'm really interested in. If I have to look at my phone again, just bear with me. I actually have someone who's going to text me things to say. You know, so like a Cervantes situation. So I might have to phone a friend if I get really lost. So Super Bowl Sunday. So I'm actually surprised to see how many people are here. Thought there were going to be like two people, but you know, my dad is boycotting the Super Bowl because he hates Tom Brady. Thinks he's like the worst person in the world. So I assume you all hate Tom Brady too, and that's why you're here. He's the quarterback for the Patriots, the guys playing in the Super Bowl. I thought you probably knew, but maybe there was someone else who was wondering, so I had answered your question symbolically. So we're about to start Sesshin, and I thought it would be appropriate to talk about Zazen, and specifically about, lots of things, but I was thinking about something that often happens in Zazen, which is what we call meditation. We also call it sitting. Especially when you're in a concentrated time of Zazen, like Sesshin is. I've found personally, and I've heard of a lot of people having very intense experiences as a result of concentrating Zazen into a shorter period of time. For whatever reason, it seems to really have a cumulative effect, much more so than doing it every day for 7 days. Doing 7 hours seems to accelerate things somehow. So I wanted to talk about kind of the phenomena of having these like really intense spiritual, or you might even call them mystical experiences, and kind of the progression of, you know, I called this talk in the newsletter, you know, I was supposed to give like a little one-line summary of what it was going to be about. So I said what I've learned in a year of practice, because I kept going back and forth on the topic, and I thought this way I can really make it about whatever I want. But I decided I wanted to talk about, you know, like the progression of, I think like for a lot of people, you know, we start sitting and we start to see kind of some of the more traditional benefits of meditation that are more well known, you know, like mindfulness-based stress reduction. You know, it can bring about a kind of emotional leveling out. It can bring about, you know, a more balanced perspective on your life, on other people, like less judgment. And those are all great things. But when I started sitting more intensively a year ago, when I came to live at Jikoji, I started to realize that, you know, there's looking at the mind that's going on, you know, in the sense of paying attention to thought. But then there starts to be something else, like almost like something else on the other side of the mirror that isn't the thoughts. And I was like, whoa, what's this? And I was like, well, this is cool. I didn't know this was part of it. And when I started to kind of have these intense experiences, I thought, why don't they advertise this? I was like, they don't talk about like the magical things that happen. This is, you know, in fact, I remember even reading someone, you know, a priest or someone saying like on this topic, you know, you may see lights, you know, you may like sense things, but just don't pay much attention. Like you don't need to chase after that. And I was like, don't pay much attention to like magical visions. Like that seems like a really exciting thing and a really pertinent thing to be thinking about and like trying to understand and, you know, studying. 'Cause it's like, feels like, oh, that's like the ultimate truth, you know, like I'm glimpsing like the, you know, this kind of otherworldly ultimate truth. You know, so I've had some pretty intense experiences, two really intense experiences, one during a Sesshin here. And after these experiences, you know, for a few days I was super high, like on, you know, I felt like so present and compassionate and just floating around, glowing, spreading love on everyone, and it didn't last. And it didn't make me a better person, to be honest. I pretty much was the same. Like, my practice grew from that. Like, I came to a greater understanding of some things. But it didn't really change my life, despite how earth-shakingly dramatic the experiences felt. Like, they felt like real glimpses into Buddha nature and, like, the essence of reality and, like, oneness with all beings. So you'd think it was, you know, you'd think that would be pretty powerful. And it was temporarily. And it, you know, made me kind of feel like, oh, I kind of get what that's about a little bit more, which is a dangerous thing to think. You know, to have a form in your mind, like loving kindness, and to have a direct experience, and then to go, that's that thing, you know, to put it in that, because it's always going to just be a box. But I wanted to talk about, you know, kind of the deeper question of what sitting does for us, if it's about something more, and at the same time more mundane than having these transcendent experiences. And I understand now why there's that non-focus in Zen on these, like, transcendental experiences, and more of a focus on the everyday and kind of the mundane. So I was really curious about that because, you know, this question of, like, why we sit, it's such a fundamental question, because sitting is the heart of Zen practice. You know, like, you'll even read, you know, like, Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind said something like, you know, there's all these things we can read and study and talk about, but really just sit. You don't, you know, if you just want to sit, that's cool. That's all that's really, like, necessary. I mean, I'm paraphrasing for sure. But so I wanted to find the connection between these esoteric sounding teachings, like on boundlessness, for instance, that we find in the Dharma, and sitting. And, like, what difference does it make for us to understand these things, to read about boundlessness, to read about, you know, loving kindness, oneness, Buddha nature? What does it matter if I have a mental concept of, okay, so this makes sense that I have Buddha nature, and, you know, Doug has Buddha nature, and that's cool. Doesn't really mean very much to my daily life. So I wanted to talk about, you know, what is boundlessness and how can we connect that? So I want to read a little passage by Sokyuni, I can't pronounce this, but he's a Tibetan Lama, something Rinpoche. And this is a book from the Tibetan tradition, but he talks about like emptiness, which is the way that I think in the past that these, it was a word that was used to indicate something that now it's been kind of accepted that emptiness is not a great word for this thing that's very hard to describe. But I found it really useful to read his translation of this Tibetan word, that it gets translated as empty. And by talking about emptiness, I'm kind of talking about that space, that experience we might have in Zazen, or that kind of ultimate reality that we talk about, you know, when we talk about the Dharma, like something that comes up a lot. So he says, the Tibetan word tongpa means empty, not in the sense of a vacuum or a void, but rather in the sense of the basis of experience that is beyond our ability to perceive with our senses, to describe, to name, or to capture in a nice, tidy concept. Maybe a better understanding of the deep sense of the word may be inconceivable or unnameable. The Sanskrit syllable ta and the Tibetan syllable ni, meanwhile, don't necessarily mean anything in themselves, but when added to an adjective or noun, they convey a sense of possibility. So when Buddhists talk about emptiness as the basis of our being, we don't mean that who or what we are is nothing, a zero or a void, a point of view that can give way to a kind of cynicism. So speaking of cynicism, another reason that I chose this topic, the background was when I first decided to give a talk, I wanted to make something pretty academic. You know, I'm not a teacher, but I thought I can put together like some primary sources and get some feedback from teachers, and I can, you know, make something that'll be educational, you know, something that'll present, you know, people will be like, oh, I learned something about this or that Dharma topic today. But I realized that like my core competency, like the thing I can speak about most articulately and with most clarity and passion, is not Dharma topics as much as I could write a research paper if I wanted to and synthesize things. It's, if you'll pardon the drama in my expression, darkness. I'm an expert on making mistakes and darkness and also existential angst. And I thought, what do people really want to hear about? Like, what are people really interested in? Something that's relevant to them, to their personal lives. And I've never met anyone for whom existential angst, anxiety, and moments of darkness in their lives was not a really, really big thing that they wrestle with. So going back to that question of, like, what does this matter? I wanted to talk about, like, Buddhism can seem to not offer a lot of consolation as far as, like, a path goes. You know, if you have Christianity, you have kind of this promise of, you know, there's a God and God loves you as an individual. Maybe you believe in a concept of heaven. And, you know, like a lot of things in Buddhism, there's a two-sided way to look at this, a non-dual way to look at it, because you can also find the concept of oneness, a Buddha nature, loving kindness to be very comforting and to kind of fill that role. But frankly, I just find that as you dismantle forms, you know, what are forms are stories. And we talk about stories in Zen as being bad things, you know, or we're not allowed to call anything bad, right? But I'm going to. Stories are illusions, or they're things we add on to what's true in the most basic sense of the word, like our direct experience. And, you know, often those stories are harmful and obscure the truth and get us into trouble. Often I have a story of that person's being mean to me and I, you know, I have a problem with this. But, you know, psychology has proven that stories are actually extremely important to our mental health and our well-being. And that actually rejecting stories and saying, I'm only going to look at reality, is more likely, people are more likely to be depressed than they are to be happier than other people. Although I'm sure, again, you can look at it as like, if you get rid of all your negative stories, that I'm sure has a positive effect. But when we have a story that our life has meaning, that we are loved by, say, God, you know, because believing in a personal God that loves you is a big indicator of resilience against depression and of happiness. You know, our stories give us a sense of groundedness. Like, our stories give us a sense of the world being orderly and us having at least the potential of having some kind of control. So I wanted to talk about, like, where can there be some kind of rest or some kind of peace that really satisfies us in on the Buddhist path? Because to me, like, the absence of some of the things that not being mindful brings up, like the absence of as much emotional ups and downs or as much anger and judgment, it's nice to take those things away, but they don't really feel, it doesn't really feel that amazing. You know, it kind of like takes down the negative, but I still have a lot of existential angst, even as my practice has grown so much and I've had so many experiences and my mind and my way of experiencing the world are completely different. But I'm not really any less angsty. So in the sense of, you know, day to day, I tend to, you know, so I wanted to talk about, you know, like how our practice can bring us to something that isn't really a good feeling. It isn't really a sense of these feelings of bliss or these feelings of reassurance, but that has its own kind of quality that that we can kind of find rest in, even without the reassurance of any kind of, you know, any kind of groundedness. So going back for a minute to, you know, the question of why do we sit and what good does it do? There was a young woman who was staying here, college student, a couple weeks ago, and she was fairly new. She was studying at a very prestigious Ivy League school, and she was studying neuroscience and philosophy. So she was interested in, you know, a very, very analytical interest in these topics, but also trying to search out. She had really only been able to experience the analytical side of this. She didn't have like a really experiential understanding. So she was really curious about, you know, she wanted to talk to me about my experience with you know, with living here and with practicing. And I'm always really excited to talk about Zen with people. I get like so enthusiastic. I'm like, it's the best. Oh my God, you won't regret it. This is the best decision you've ever made to be interested in this. It's the best thing I've ever found in my life, like the most precious gift. So people are like, oh, okay, cool. Like, tell me more. What's it like? And I'm like, it's like slamming your hand in a drawer, like over and over and over and over. or maybe like touching a hot stove and like realizing you're touching it, but like not being able to stop yourself. And it just like never stops and like never gets better. From my like, I was like, it's awful. Oh my God, but it's so much fun. So if bookings drop off at Jikoji, you guys will know that it's because I've been telling people. So she's like, okay. And I didn't like think that through. That's not like my position. It's just, that's honestly like what comes out when I talk about, at least speaking for myself and where I am on the path, it feels like I'm duck crawling through the mud, you know, like at boot camp when you're like, you see them crawling under like the barbed wire, and I do move forward, but the end just moves further away. It's just like this magical, like gain an inch, it just extends an inch. And I think part of my practice is just like accepting that, like, well, that's what this practice is, just, you know, taking the hit over and over and over and over. So that, I think, adds context to, you know, when we talk about why we sit, the kind of party line, and there's different ways of looking at this, is often like something about like how there's no reason, or like we don't sit to attain anything. And that sounded really pretentious to me when I first, you know, like I remember someone asked us all in a talk like this to say why we sit. And somebody said, no reason. And I was like, what a pretentious asshole. Like, like, oh, sure, you know, because I'm very literal. I was like, you know, we're humans. We're doing everything for a reason. And I said, I sit to be free. And I think that actually those are kind of the same thing. Like, as I've sat more, you know, we sit to dismantle the activities of the ego that are masking who we really are. And until we can do that, like until we can get some space from that, we can't be free, you know? So I think that my answer to that now would be a little bit of both of those, would be like, there's no other, to me, like the journey towards freedom is a natural outcome of our true nature, which is awareness. And, you know, there's a quote in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that I think actually opens the book, that says, it is wisdom that is seeking for wisdom. And I really like that. And, you know, the girl that I was talking to, the student, you know, after I told her this, she said, wow, like at the end of our conversation, she was like, that sounds really terrible. Do you ever think about quitting? And it never even occurred to me that I could quit, like that was an option. It's like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I should consider that. But yeah, I'm kidding, because like it was hard for me to explain to her that there's no way to quit. It's not really a matter of initiative. Once you've started on the path, it's like, you know, they say like you see something really grotesque or horrible and people will joke like, I can't unsee that. I can't get that image out of my mind. Like, whether it's painful or not, it's our path to continue. And it's just something that's going to happen, actually, whether we like it or not, like whether we fight it or not, whether we practice or not. On some level, there's no going back, because you just can't buy into it anymore. Like, you just can't buy into the things that you bought into. It's like, well, I've seen the man behind the curtain now. Like in The Wizard of Oz, you know, I can't go back. Another thing that it says in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is that this is the only way of life for a human being. There is no other way. And I think that applies to everybody, whether they're practicing or not, whether they like it or not. This is what's really going on. And this activity, or what seems to be activity of this becoming more free, is more fundamental to us than the activity of trying to find happiness or trying to find peace or trying to find knowledge, because the foundation of all of these things is to become free. And that freedom, to go back to that quote about emptiness, that freedom is something that isn't really a a concept or a thing. Like, we have to talk about it with, you know, some kind of word. But it's that connection of reality, that connection to reality and of awareness essentially seeking itself. It's its nature. Another term that I, you know, we chanted in the sutra, boundlessness, is another term for, I consider it to be another term for emptiness or Buddha nature, or, you know, however you want to talk about it. And a teacher pointed out to me that boundlessness, you know, it conveys a sense of kind of free floating oneness, non-contained in a body or in an individual being. But bounds are also like bonds. So in a way it means, you know, it relates to the term being in bondage. So you know, you get out of bondage, but bonds also like, you know, wrap you up and comfort you. So there's something very, very unsettling and very, you know, anxiety producing, I think, about the Zen path. At least that's often, you know, I think an experience people have. And I don't think that really gets talked about, because we gloss over it with, oh, but Buddha nature and loving kindness. And those things don't comfort me when I'm depressed, like the but I've been told about how, even though I feel really alone right now, it's like, oh, but you're one with all beings. I'm like, fuck you. Like, I don't feel one with all beings. Like, that doesn't mean anything to me. And even though I've had that experience of feeling that way, it still doesn't mean anything more to me when I'm, you know, in a dark place. Because it's not how I'm feeling. You know, it's an abstract. So it's like, but with increased practice, what I find is that there's something much more subtle that develops, that is more powerful and more meaningful than this grand construct of the oneness of all things or Buddha nature or loving kindness, because it's truly unbounded, because it is in that formless place that is really like where reality is and where we really are. So it takes it out of this conceptual place. So that's another thing that, as you know, I've practiced more and more, I've found something a lot more subtle seeping into my daily life that doesn't really give me a comfort, and yet it feels tremendously worthwhile. I can't say that it makes me feel good, but I can say that it's the best thing that anyone could ever have, and that's the best way that I can describe it. And that's why I can say, like, to this girl, you know, like, oh, it really sucks and it's the best. And you just have to, you just have to do it to know what I'm talking about. I don't know if there are that many things that you can say that about, except for maybe like parenthood. I've heard people express similar things about, you know, it's like, or maybe love, depending on what's going on and what your love relationship is like. I think that's something that would qualify. So I told this young woman, trying to talk about like how Zazen had changed my life and had changed me as I'd practiced. I told her about an experience I'd had fairly recently that kind of was emblematic of the subtler changes that had happened, and that this other thing that I had found that wasn't a thing. I was up on the ridge and I was hiking up there, and I was about to do something that I was really scared to do. Like, I was literally in an hour or so, I was going to leave, and I was really scared. And as I was walking, I had this experience where I saw my fear and saw that it was, but I saw it as being no different from everything else. And it wasn't that it wasn't distinct. It wasn't that it was absorbed into this vague, like, idea of, but I saw it as just being existent with all of the other things, all of the trees, all of the other emotions and thoughts I had, like all of the, it was just one of these things. And she said, well, how did that make you feel? And I said, I didn't feel anything, but it was awesome. And you know, that's the kind of experience that I've had more and more, is that there's something in it, but it's not this blissful experience. And it can produce a lot of anxiety. Like if you think about it, that neutral feeling of going through the world, which I've had experiences of, especially after intensive meditation, of just feeling, to pardon the expression, kind of nothingness, like to feel like I was just floating in groundlessness. And I didn't really feel anything. And if I think about it, it seems kind of frightening. But at the time, there's something profoundly restful. And to use an example from the Bible, and you know, he says in this book, Open Heart, Open Mind, I like the way he describes it, that like the fundamental questions of the spiritual path are present in all religions. So you can find, so take this, you know, non-literally or take it as you like. But there's this story in the Old Testament of this prophet who is waiting. He's in a bad situation. I think he's hiding in a cave from somebody that wants to kill him. Typical, you know, typical prophet problems to be having. It's pretty predictable issue to get into if you're going to choose that lifestyle. Because they were like the contrarians of, you know, the rebels, or like the civil disobedience people that were speaking out against the powers that be. That was kind of prophet's role back then. Speaking for the voice of morality against the voice of power. So this guy's in a cave and he's like, you know, waiting to hear from God. Like, you know, he's kind of like somebody, like there's a flood and they're like up on the roof and they're like waiting for the helicopter. And they're like, okay, I know you're going to come, just, you know, whenever is convenient for you, come get me. And so then he sees this, like, there's this great fire, this great column of fire he sees. And he's like, oh, there, that must be, because in the Old Testament, God tends to show up in these ways, right? So there's this big column of fire, and he's like, oh, cool, like this, you know. And so he looks for God, but God's not in the fire. And then there's this huge storm with lightning and thunder and rain, and he's like, God, you're here, but God's not in the storm. And there's like a flood or something, and he's like, okay, this is it. This has got to be, you know, third time's the charm. This is, but you know, no God. And then you can probably guess, you know, what happens. He's sitting alone in the dark and he hears like a still small voice inside him. And that's God. And it says, God is not in the fire. Like God is not in the storm. And you know, it's not dramatic and it's hard to put your finger on, like, what is this? What is this experience? What is this? You know, is this real? Like, is this, when I have these subtler experiences now, it's like, is this me? Is this me connecting to the Buddha field? Is this, but you know, I don't need those answers anymore. And I've pretty much lost all my interest in mystical experiences, which they were a big area of interest for me and something that had kind of defined my spiritual path up until this transition. And I just feel like I don't need to know anymore. Like I don't need to be comforted with anything. And I think to kind of bring that being punched in the face over and over again quality that the Zen path has to me of just seeing my own frailty over and over and over and over. I think part of it is that, you know, I'm mindful enough now to see when I screw up, but not to stop myself. So it's just really painful to see myself messing up all day, every day, a million times a day. Is that like it really humbles us and strips away practice in general, whether you find it to be constantly humiliating or not, as I do. It'll strip away that sense of self and those defenses. And those are our bounds. And it'll just leave us like really, really vulnerable. And you know, when you're vulnerable, that's when things can touch you. Like that's when you can touch something. So I think that's the path or the progression of practice. And to use another example from the Christian tradition, that's always meant a lot to me. That's the tradition that I come from. I was talking to this woman. I used to work at a church. And there was this woman who worked with me whose husband had just left her. And she had two like small daughters and it was a really bad situation. And she was handling it with so much grace. And I just had so much respect for this woman. And she said something to me in that conversation. She was a scholar of Hebrew. Like she was studying Hebrew. And she said that, you know, there's this famous line in the Bible that's, "Be still and know that I am God." And, you know, you hear that, people will kind of say that, or it's a concept that floats around, be still. And, you know, when we hear be still, which of course you can apply to Zazen, to practice, you know, stillness, emptiness, we think of being, you know, quiet, like being at peace, you know, like at rest. And I can't guarantee that I'll ever be at peace in a particular moment or situation. I can't just say, okay, Kecia, we're going to be at peace now. You know, we're just going to do that. And I'm not going to rely on my ability to be at peace as like an achievement of my practice to feel fulfilled by what I'm doing. And I don't even think personally that we should seek being at peace, because you just can't, you know, it's like, it's almost like an ego thing, you know, like to say, I will be at peace. I will get to this point. There's a lot of construction added into that idea. But she said that like the Hebrew term for stillness actually is better translated as be weak. Like be, think of someone like laying on the ground, not because they're so composed and evolved that they're just sitting in a meditative state of stillness, but because they can't do anything else. They don't have any power. They don't have any, you know, we could say any being force, any I, any of the things that we could hold on to and say, well, I have this thing I can, you know, that I can cling to and that I can use. And I think that that's really helpful when I think about my own continued screwing up and continued, you know, existential angst, and the comfort that I have found in these like much more mundane and subtle moments of feeling some connection and not needing it to be God or not needing to label it or to know what it is like, I can just rest as my actual self without needing to have any concepts around it. Like I can be, I was in Whole Foods actually when this occurred to me, like this way of thinking about it. And I was having a really crappy day and I looked really bad and I was not doing very well at what I aspire to be as a person. And I was just wandering aimlessly around Whole Foods. And I had this moment of just being aware of a kind of intimacy is the best way I can describe it. The intimacy of like, if you've ever been with someone and just not been speaking and, you know, not needing to speak. And there's a quality of listening, this listening quality of almost like you're listening so intently that you can hear yourself breathing, but you're not listening for something. It's not like you're listening expecting a sound. But there's just this wonderful intimacy and beauty of just being like really tender and really open. And for me, it feels like resting in the arms of God, frankly, without having actually, you know, forms or ideas around that. That's from my tradition. That's a way that I can describe it that helps to describe the feeling. How many of you know what child's pose is in yoga? You do? Can somebody demonstrate it for me just really quickly? Like somebody in the front, just so people can see it that don't know how to do it. Great. You notice how it kind of looks like a prostration? Like it kind of looks like you're humbling yourself, which I think is also very significant. Humbling yourself is a concept that really gets a lot of attention in Christianity. Like humbling yourself to God specifically. Like that idea of, and I think that in a different way, in Zen, what we do when we practice and we dismantle these things is essentially humbling ourselves, saying, I'm going to take off all these ideas I have about what makes me so great and what the delusions I have and the stories I have that make me, you know, feel good. So child's pose is very restful. It's a wonderful, it feels wonderful. I think it's one of the poses I most enjoy just physically. And I remember in one of my first yoga classes, the teacher saying, like, if you get lost, you know, if this is moving too fast for you or you get tired, just assume child's pose. It's It's like, if you need a break during yoga, just get into child's pose. And I remember like being very amused at myself because I joked like, that's good advice for life. Like, so now like I think to myself, if I'm overwhelmed, like with like tongue in cheek, like assume child's pose, assume child. Like, you're in a meeting or something. It's like, assume child's pose. I'm just going to like, and that's how I feel when I feel like surrendered to this nothingness or this boundlessness. And what Zazen really leaves us with when it seeps into our daily life. And I think that it's very appropriate that it's called child's pose because, you know, think of like a child really brings up this idea of, you know, having, not needing to take care of oneself alone, like not needing to be reliant on our own strength, like not even having strength, and just kind of like this trust. So when I think of prostration, like when I think of that humbling oneself, I really think of it not so much as, you know, you're great, God, again, metaphorically or whatever, you know, this idea of like, oh, I'm just so lowly and there's this thing that's greater than myself and I'm just petitioning it to be allowed to be kind of involved, you know, like in its fold. It's really more of like a child to me, like reaching out like to its parents, and the surrender of that and the trust in that. So to me, that's the way that, to kind of sum up, the way that my practice has helped me to find something in the world that I don't think there's any other source of, but that I think is the one thing that can be really relied on, which is pretty exciting, even though it sucks, like, in my opinion. There's this verse in, to use another, you know, another Christian term, there's this verse in the Psalms, which are a series of kind of very mystical, they're actually songs originally, almost like love poems that were written to God. And the one of my favorite verses is when my flesh fails me, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. And I think that that's something we can all relate to. I think that's a universal thing. Every single person in this room and every single person in Santa Clara County has had moments where they're like, my strength is failing me. And there's no one, I swear to God, like not one single person in the world that can say, I have always been able to overcome that. Like I have always been able to, you know, I've always had every moment I've ever had of saying, wow, I'm just really at the end of my rope. I've always been able to just 100% take care of it. You know, like I just really got it all down and recovered. So it's like we've all failed in that way. And frankly, I think most of us continue to fail our whole lives. This is heretical for me to say, so this is not the official position of Jokoji, but I don't really believe in enlightenment, permanent enlightenment. Like I hear like some people just get to a point where they just don't do that stuff anymore or have those experiences anymore. I have never met this person. So if you want to like nominate someone to me, whenever I hear about that, you know, like, oh, he's an enlightened teacher. I'm like, I wonder if his wife and his kids think so. Like, I wonder if the people that live with him are like, oh, he's totally perfect. He never slips. He never has any moments of doubt or angst or irritation or, you know. Yeah. So I'm going to read another little passage and then we can do some questions. I don't know what time it is. 12:21. Okay. This is from a book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which is one of the most incredible books I've ever read. Chongyam Trungpa. Lisa actually, who's around here somewhere, brought it to me and offered me a passage from it. And I was like, oh, okay. But this is actually like chock full of, I'd really recommend this. It's hardcore. Like it's you know, as there's a lot of really convicting stuff in here. Convicting, like, is a Christian term that people use, like, oh, I was really convicted by that. Like, something really spoke to my heart and made me wake up. It's not like guilt. It's like, ooh, like, I didn't want to know that about myself, but now I do. So he says, disappointment is the best chariot to use on the path of the Dharma. It does not confirm the existence of our ego and its dreams. If we regard spirituality as a way of making ourselves comfortable, then whenever we experience something unpleasant, a disappointment, we try to rationalize it. Then he goes into a series of rationalizations of how, you know, it seems like there's no guarantee of anything being perfect and perfection being possible. But then, you know, then they go, but, you know, I have these things that these spiritual truths or these kind of spiritual egoic accomplishments, you know, things I feel good about. So I can afford to open. I can safely surrender. We must surrender our hopes and expectations, as well as our fears, and march directly into disappointment. Work with disappointment, go into it, and make it our way of life. That's pretty, it's hard to really sell Zen to people if you tell them, like, you're going to make disappointment your way of life. It's not, you know, I mean, Zen definitely, like, I can see why, you know, we don't market it more, because, like, if we had to really market it, it would be awkward. Like, we'd get into some awkward situations trying to, like, make the promote. I just don't think we'd be very good at it for multiple reasons. It doesn't really lend itself well to advertising. I read one more little thing. When we open psychologically and surrender completely by identifying ourselves with the lowest of the low and the weakest of the weak, there is nothing that we fear to lose when we identify ourselves with that. The refuge seeker has no real basic strength at all, no true inspiration. On this path, we have committed ourselves to the pain of exposing ourselves, of taking off our clothes, our skin, nerves, heart, brains, until we are exposed to the universe. Nothing will be left. It will be terrible and excruciating, and that is the way it is. But also really awesome. That part was me.
Are you doing questions?
Okay. Whatever people want to do.
Okay. One thing that I personally, like, it's not been useful to me when they say, yes, it is going to be terrible and excruciating, mm-hmm. because you label it unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And then if I really believe in that, and I have, that's why I don't like it.
Yeah.
If I believe, yes, this is terrible and I'm strong enough, it's like strong in my weakness, right? Like, I'm mm-hmm. so weak, I can handle any terrible thing.
Mm.
Then that also is not really true. I don't know. It's just...
It's dualistic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just something that's happening. It's not great. It's not bad. It's just something's happening. It's interesting. And, I mean, that's been more useful to me, to call it interesting. And it never stays. It'll change. So, like, to say something like, I'm going to make disappointment my way of life, like, you know, like, doesn't that sound like a martyr, like, flagellating themselves?
I see where you're going. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think that you're right that it is dualistic to talk about it in that way. But I think that the thing about arguing with a Buddhist is that we can deconstruct everything. Like, literally, like, it's terrible, because, like, you can be in an argument and then somebody can just go, but form is boundlessness and boundlessness is form. And, you know, that's dualism. And the other person can go, well, that's dualism, to say that that's dualism. So anything that we say, there's going to be, like, a way in which it's, you can critique it. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I don't mean it that way. Like, I don't think of it when I say disappointment must be, I think maybe the first thing I would say is, like, there's pain and there's suffering. what I can say from my own direct experience is that, like, I experience a lot of pain. I don't think it has to be, I can't say for you that you will experience the kind of pain that I do on, like, a daily, you know, when I'm like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, I did that, oh shit. That's the kind of pain I mean. Like, I'm constantly like, oh, I did it again. Oh my God, why did I do that? Like, to me, those are like the punches in the face, right? I can say that that's my experience, that that's real, the pain. That doesn't mean that suffering is necessarily like what I'm talking about. Although obviously, like, for, you know, I think for most people that will come up too. But when I say, you know, making disappointment a way of life, I'm more thinking of this idea of, like, no attainment than I am of this, like, self-martyring, you know, yeah, if that makes sense. I think that's a valid point, and I agree that, like, it is labeling it. But I think it's also good to talk about the real experience that many of us have, you know, like, and not maybe, like, an abstract, like, you know, if your experience is that you don't feel those things, then that's great. A lot of people do, and I do. So I'm more talking about, like, this is just a reality that a lot of us do experience. And I think that when I say, like, oh, it's awful, but it's fun, there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, I think, acknowledgement in there of when I say, like, oh my God, it sucks, like, that I'm being a little bit facetious. It's kind of like when you tease someone affectionately. Like, you can have a very complex relationship with someone you love where there's kind of your own language for how you speak to them and for what it means and, you know, what teasing them means to you and means to them. So, you know, you'll have to, everybody will have to find their own way of relating to just, like, the reality of, like, what life is. I'm not going to say, oh, the reality that life sucks and will always be difficult. I'm not really talking about that even. I'm just saying the reality of just what is, like, whatever will, you know, will come to be, and the way practice will change how we relate to that. And I've analogized it as being like a relationship or like an intimacy, even if that's an intimacy with our own being and awareness, or of awareness with itself. And like any relationship, that's going to have its own individual unique quality for everyone. There's a saying I really like, which is, no one ever knows what's going on in someone's marriage, including their own. You know, intimacy, and things that are kind of beyond words. I think that's part of, like, the richness of them, is that, that kind of ambiguity. It's another quote that actually someone, a Zen priest, I don't even know if it's a quote. I think it was just something that he said. Like, I think it was a quote by him. And we were talking about, I had recently broken up with a boyfriend, and I forget how it came up, but we were talking about love and my love for him. And he said, not knowing is the greatest intimacy. And I didn't think that made a lot of sense, frankly. I mean, I'm willing to credit a lot of things as making some kind of sense, but I really was like, I really don't, those words don't really mean anything, I don't think. But they've come to mean something to me, and my practice and how it's related to my experience of this boundless quality of life have been a really key part of how that idea of not knowing being the greatest kind of intimacy has spread out into my relationships and into my experience of the world. Thank you, Leela. She's my best friend, by the way, so.
Sorry, I realized I was a little aggressive there. People don't know that I'm your best
friend. No, I love it. Be as aggressive as you want to be, all of you. Like, I'm...
Yeah, I really appreciate your talk and also your bringing out the boundedness of boundless. You know, you can consider boundless boundedness as is wrapped in tight, and to be unbound is I could see where that would not bring comfort, and I hadn't seen that kind of boundlessness. I usually think of how I was just, it's endless and changing. So I appreciate you bringing out that. The notion of emptiness is empty of self-existence, is how it's formally defined. But I like this, speaking about, of emptiness, but to the feeling bound is an important aspect to consider in maybe the Heart Sutra, is how we are bound, and we are bound. I'll work with this, so thank you.
For, thank you.
That kind of idea. I don't know if you have any more to say on that.
No, I don't think so. Not at this time, but thank you for your...
Kisi, I love this talk. I... Excuse me. It was... It just touched on so many things that are just to the bone. I call it to the bone, you know, close to the bone of my own experience as well, of darkness, you know, and of my search for solace. And you articulated it so well. And that is such a gift, because it kind of allows me to recognize that I'm not alone, kind of in a strange way, in being alone. And that kind of commonality. The other thing I wanted to say about Zen, you know, the way that you touched on, I don't know. I don't know is so rare to find, the willingness to say, I don't know. You just think about in our culture, in any kind of workplace, in any kind of relationship, certainly in any kind of spirituality. I don't know is a sign of great weakness. But yet, I agree with you. I think if I understood what you're saying is, that is the nature of things. And just like there's multiple levels and realities, not knowing still doesn't mean you can't love with your whole heart. And so how do these two things work? Don't have to worry about that. I mean, that's how I have come to think about it. I just recognize I can love with my whole heart and feel in moments desperately alone. And you know, you think about just this moment right now of Sangha. That's what this is about, is listening to you right now, and the power of it. So I just want to say thank you for opening your heart so freely to all of us.
Thanks. I realize my core competency is just like being really willing and eager to and amused by talking about my own fuck-ups. That's the primary value add that I bring to... I'm serious. Like, when I think of what do people like affirm me for most in my life, like, it's usually just in my day-to-day. Like, so, you know, you gotta stick with your strengths. Setting myself up for success.
This wasn't that, though.
This wasn't
the fuck
up. Hi, Lisa. Hi. What you said just now reminded me that how I read... it was some philosophy book that I was reading about Christianity, but that basically Jesus was totally a failure, and that Jesus succeeded through his failure. So I wanted to share that. That's not my words, but I've always appreciated that passage that I remember from that book, which I can't remember the book.
Yeah. And I think to what Leela said about, you know, labeling and like the, you know, like not getting caught into an idea or a form or a concept necessarily of, you know, being a failure or being weak or being, you know, because these are all ideas. It's true. And like, I'm just speaking to a thing that is a reality, and experiencing those things is a reality, you know, so, but also experiencing maybe feeling differently can also be someone's reality, but that's not so much what I'm talking about here. But I think that, you know, when you said like, oh, Jesus was like a failure, when I'm in that state of like real connectedness to awareness, I'm not like, oh, I'm a failure. I'm such a worm. I'm so weak. I don't have like those labels or that sense of like, even like humility, because there's not this need to, there's such a vulnerability and a trust that I don't even need to like worry about. I don't have any impetus. Like no one is pushing me to even need to say anything, you know, or to be anything. And there's actually a kind of pride in a weird way. Like when I had that moment in Whole Foods, when I was just like feeling like total shit, it wasn't like this cognitive emotional thing where I was feeling like a piece of shit. But then I like realized that really that was all I had to like be. It was something other than that. It was more of this almost kind of like resilient, without puffing myself up with any like congratulatory or comforting phrases or ideas about myself. There was almost like this kind of desire to laugh with like, not like about some thought of like the absurdity of life or of ego, but just kind of this like, yeah, like, yeah, it was just a very like special moment where I didn't feel crappy and weak and like, oh, it's gonna, you know, it transformed into something else. And there was almost like this sense of confidence, not in something, but there was this kind of sense of goodness, of like, almost like there was this light shining on me, like from my heart, but like from the heart of what I really was. And it felt really good. It felt safer than I had ever felt through feeling more safe, like safe through secure or reflecting something really positive being reflected back at me about myself. It was a safe place and the only safe place, and I didn't feel like a failure, even though it started with that kind of acknowledgement or realization of, hey, this is all I have to be, you know, is this is the best. Like wandering around Whole Foods feeling like garbage in my dirty yoga pants, this is the best me, this is the best moment, this sweetness, you know.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.